Hosting for this podcast is made possible through mtgcast.com, which is supported by a generous contribution from quietspeculation.com, Magic's premier trading and financial news site.
Hello and welcome to Serious Vintage. I'm Jeff Mose.
I'm Nat Mose.
And I'm Josh Chappell.
Today we'll be talking about the latest You Make the Card details, discussions about the new Dragon's Maze spoilers, building a vintage community, and also a discussion about food and drink in Vegas for the Modern Masters GP.
Yeah, so we have two special guests today. We have Joe McKellar and Heather Meek from Las Vegas. Joe and Heather have been getting together a vintage community there. They're sort of starting from the ground up. I know Joe has done a lot of work, and Heather is just has suddenly gotten into vintage and is now a very vocal proponent for the format, which is awesome.
So, yeah, I do talk a lot.
Yeah. So we're just trying to get them in, and you know, we'll talk about some ideas for getting a vintage group started in your own area if you don't have one, and where to find people online if you can. So we welcome both of them.
Hi, thank you guys for having us.
Hey everyone, how's it going?
So I don't know if you guys have been paying attention. The You Make the Card campaign has been going on.
And, I was paying attention until they didn't make an Artifact Angel.
Well, we have
someday they will.
Decided earlier that they're basically just going to make functional reprints of either Necropotence or Chains.
Yeah. So what they have right now, we the user have so far voted for a black enchantment. Right now, until midnight tonight, we have the choice between global enchantment or aura. And I suppose after that, they'll start getting into mechanics.
I'm pretty sure as vintage people, we know which we want to win in this vote.
Yeah, aura.
Wait, but doesn't the thing say enchant world?
No, global enchantment.
Oh, man, if it were enchant world, that would be insane.
Yeah, because you can only have one enchant world.
Yeah.
Right.
On the board at the time.
Yeah, that would be awesome. I wish actually that they'd had that be. Maybe it would be if global enchantment gets voted in.
Yeah, that would be sweet.
They'll bring back the enchant world mechanic. But yeah, I think it's going to be interesting. Like I think Josh said that they're either going to do Necropotence or Chains of Mephistopheles. That sounds great.
Yeah, I'd be okay with either of those.
I can't wait until Chains of Mephistopheles is a commonly played standard card.
One thing that we were talking about that we kind of didn't really know what to think about is that they weren't posting standings currently. So, you know, like, how do you know that voting actually means anything?
Yeah.
Well, Nat, you linked something where some guy was like, I personally voted at least 10,000 times for white and there were only 8,000 votes for white. So something's fishy.
I mean, did I tell you he wrote that article?
I may know someone who set up a bot to vote for white, and he apparently voted for white 10,000 times and was disappointed to see that it only had 7,600 votes or whatever.
That's fantastic.
So I'm pretty sure, as I said before, Wizards can pretty much do whatever they want because there's not a lot of transparency here.
I mean, also, it's impressive that you can waste 10,000 votes.
Well, he wasn't doing it by hand. He set up a vote to do that. I mean, he set up
still,
a vote.
But you still took the time to vote for white.
Right. Right.
Because white needs more enchantments.
Well, I mean, white is an enchantment color. It would have been good to have it be working with Sarah's Sanctum and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's true.
But, you know, as I said, it's just going to be a neat exercise, and I think we just sort of have to watch and wait to see how it goes. So. We'll keep watching the You Make the Card, but for now we'll move on. Dragon's Maze is coming out soon, and got spoilers on the line. I think one of the most interesting things is that split cards are coming back. That's always one of my favorite mechanics. I mean, fire and ice is pretty cool and vintage, and I know research and development was played in Doomsday before Labman got printed. But
I really wanted hide and seek to be good.
Yeah, I was really psyched on hide and seek. Yeah.
Yeah, I forgot about that one. But we have a couple new split cards coming out that potentially have vintage applications. Actually, there are probably a few of them, but I think Wear and Tear is probably the most basic one. That's half Shatter, half Destroy Target Enchantment, which I think is...
It could have been something really great, but with the Shatter costing 2, it's just not quite there. Like, this card could have been a really beautiful, elegant, simplistic... One red to shatter, one white to destroy an enchantment. As it is, it's just sort of like, at least in an eternal format, it's why not play disenchant?
Yeah, I think it's probably not gonna quite make the cut. The one thing they did with the split cards this time is the fuse mechanic, which allows you to play both halves at the same time.
Does Wear and Tear have fuse?
Yeah, they all do.
Oh, I didn't realize they have fuse. That makes it better than I thought then.
Yeah, it's a mechanic designed specifically for the card type this set.
Right. So after Wear and Tear, which I think is a pretty basic utility spell, might see some play in Vintage in a red-white 8 deck. We move on and we get Beck and Call. And I think Call is pretty much ignorable, but Beck is an already playable effect. It's essentially, what is that card?
Glimpse of Nature.
Yeah, Glimpse of Nature.
Except it costs twice as much as Glimpse, doesn't it? Isn't Glimpse one green?
Yeah.
It's a green and a black for it.
It does cost more, but it also has a better effect in that it's not when a creature is cast, it's when a creature enters the battlefield.
Oh yeah, that's true.
So it triggers on tokens. So if, for example, you were to play Mox Emerald, Mox Sapphire, Black Lotus, Rite of Flame, back, empty the Warrens, I think you draw, what, 10 cards? Maybe 12? I think 12.
Something like that, yeah. Yeah, I was trying to figure out when I heard about this if there was anything that like skip a draw, put a token into play, but I don't think any of those effects exist to like go infinite.
Well, I think the big one is Zombie Infestation.
Yeah.
Because you can, if you have a card in hand, you can discard it, put a zombie into play, that triggers back, you draw a card, you can discard that, put a zombie into play.
But you have to discard 2 cards.
Yeah.
Oh, it is just discard 2?
Yeah, Zombie Infestation is 2 cards. You're getting one of the card disadvantage backs, but ultimately, still kinda sour.
What? Who was talking about that card? That card's terrible.
Well, it is Ohio, I mean, it...
Paul Nicola used to play that card all the time.
I know. Yeah, I mean... Okay, so it's not that good. But anyway, it might be a good as some number of Glimpse of Natures up to 8 in an Elves deck, that sort of thing.
I don't think you want 8 Glimpses in Elves, though, because you don't want to draw into Glimpses and Beck and Calls. You want to draw into, Elves, Viridian Shamans and...
Right.
Well, doesn't the Elves deck run for...
Skull Clamps?
Skull Clamps anyway? Like, I mean, I could see having maybe a 5th Glimpse... Because it kind of does an extra thing too, so like if you happen to have it, you glimpse and then you cast that, because we all know that there's no issue for mana for Elves decks.
Right.
And then like every time you play a guy, like you're drawing 2 cards off of it. So it just gives you like, I guess it gives you a 5th effect, you know, whereas if you, it kind of like double glimpsing.
Right. Oh, and it might get some more use off of the, you know, token generation sort of thing. I mean, you could maybe make some changes and
Snake Basket.
Yeah, the old Snake Plissken deck. So, I mean, that will probably see at least some experimentation early on. I think one card that I was sort of interested in is the Render Silent card, which is an instant counter-target spell. Its controller can't cast spells this turn. It costs 2 blue and a white, which is Counterspell plus Orm's Chant. I mean, we were sort of talking about the blue-white control decks last week and last month, whenever that was. Anyway, and I think this could see some play in a deck like that where you really want to shut them down for a turn.
Yeah, I think ultimately this seems honestly best in a deck like Restoration Snap Control, where the drawback of costing 3 is not as great when you don't actually have anything to do with your main phase with your mana. I mean, mana drain is advantageous because it only costs 2, so with 4 mana you can drop something that costs 2 on your turn or do something like that and still have 2 up. But with all your creatures having flash, all the spells you want to play being at instant speed, then having those 3 up isn't necessarily 3 mana that you're not doing anything with if you don't use it to counter.
Right.
Well, to be fair too, with this card, like, it's not just a 3 casting cost spell. Like, it's effectively 3.5 mana because it costs 2 blue and a white. That's pretty specific, especially when most blue decks and vintage don't really have many white sources.
I don't really want to play white, yeah.
Yeah, like if they're playing any white, like it's gonna be just the mocks, and if they are playing, Tundras, I just don't feel like that card fits in more of like the Bomberman-esque shells. I mean, I guess it could see some play in like the new style of keeper decks that are kind of popping up like around the central United States that are playing City of Brass. So they can run like the one of swords, et cetera,
right. It's also bad in a counter war because you can just play it and then your opponent just continues to counter your spell with it on the stack and it doesn't happen.
Oh yeah. Well, like also like if you're fighting on the stack with that card, 3 million, like 3 mana is like 1 million.
Yeah.
True.
Like, you just get so much more value out of cards like Spell Pierce, Flusterstorm, Spell Snare, etc.
Mind-break Trap, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, Mind-break Trap obviously becomes amazing in those situations.
Right.
I think you're also right in, like, generally in Vintage, if you're casting a 3-drop, you probably want to be able to cast that off of land Mox.
Right.
And you're highly unlikely to have that combination when you have 3-colored mana requirements.
Yeah. Well, and I think the other thing, too, is that Orym's Chant is the Orym's Chant effect, the Orym's Chant, Abeyance, that sort of thing, is better as a proactive effect where you do it on your opponent's upkeep and don't let them even cast the first spell.
Yeah, that's true.
So, you know, why are you waiting for them to do something when you can just stop them entirely?
That's an effect that, like, cards like Duress and Thoughtseize kind of handle as well. Like, if you're gonna be forced to use slots for a card like that, you'd be better off just running, like, Drain and Thoughtseize. Or Drain and Duress, where they can actually do those things proactively.
Right. Another card that we looked at was Blood Scrivener, which is sort of a modified Dark Confidant. This is a zombie wizard creature, costs 1 and a black. Its text says, if you would draw a card while you have no cards in hand, instead draw 2 cards and lose 1 life.
I think this is the card that I saw people talking about in combination with Zombie Infestation, because you can get Hellbent and then always be drawing from 0.
Right.
If that's...
So you drew a 2/2 token?
Yeah.
Right. Every time.
Yeah.
You draw a 2/2 token that is also 2 cards.
Yeah, I want to play against that deck.
I'm just saying what Spare people trade. Are talking. Nat brought up Zombie Infestation.
I'm sorry, I did. I didn't realize it cost 2 cards.
Yeah, it's way better terrible. At 1 card.
Jeez.
At 1 card.
No kidding. Yeah, my feeling on Blood Scrivener is that, you know, with Dark Confidant, you always know what it's going to do. You might not always know how much damage you're going to take, but you know you're going to draw an extra card at the beginning of your upkeep. And with Blood Scrivener, you might draw extra cards, but do you really want to be hellbent to do that?
That card might be some type of playable in maybe Dark Times, but, like, your control decks are all about card advantage anyway. Like, if you're at 0 cards, you're probably lost the game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because you're certainly not holding counter spells in your hand until you can draw a card, right?
So. No, exactly. And I feel like, why would you want that card when Bob is just infinitely better?
Right.
Yeah. I guess that's the same thing for Dark Times, too, is that Bob is just better.
And combos mean. Terribly with Blood Scrivener.
What's that? Bob does?
Bob, yeah. Because he puts the card into your hand before you draw.
Right. I mean, Blood Scrivener combos bad with itself anyway.
Right. Yeah, because it doesn't make it so you draw an extra card, you draw 2 cards. If you have 2 Blood Scriveners out and you're going to draw a card, you're going to draw 2 cards, but you're not going to draw 3 or 4 if you have 2.
I feel like if you were thinking about running that card, like if you were desperate enough to run it in your deck, you'd be better off just spending the extra mana on running Phyrexian Arena. Because at least you know you're gonna get the card every turn.
I love that card.
Enchantment is a lot more difficult to deal with on the
board. Oh, enchantments are tough
Jeff
to deal with.
Jeff has actually made his choice. And I think last but not least, we've got Ral Zarek, the new Planeswalker. He's a man color.
Is pure sexy.
There you go. I think that's all we need to say, really, right?
He's got that thing coming right out of his crotch. It really is.
Do I have to look this up and see what this iron looks like? All right.
You're right. You got a little benchmark mouthpiece there.
Oh, if you look at the Star City Games comment thread on this announcement for this card, somebody was like, is he playing with his nipples?
Oh my god, I never noticed that.
Oh man.
I mean, it's no Earthbind, but.
Anyway, he costs 2, a red, and a blue. Comes into play with 4 loyalty counters. He has 3 abilities. The first one is a +1 ability that taps or and untaps a target permanent. So you tap one target permanent, then untap another one. The next one is a -2 ability that deals 3 damage to target creature or player, basically a sorcery speed lightning bolt. And the third ability is a -7 ability that also has you flip 5 coins, and then you take an extra turn for each one that comes up heads. I think that's pretty... I mean, the first 2 abilities are certainly vintage relevant. Tapping and untapping permanents. You can go infinite with Time Vault for 1. I mean, I think that's probably the most important. You can also reuse things like Goblin Welder, Tarmogoyf, that sort of thing. Dealing 3 damage is pretty good. Obviously, being able to hit your opponent is nice, and you also get to kill things like Lodestone Golem and other creatures. And then you get to the third one, where it's like this totally random, here comes variance, flip 5 coins ability.
Right. Yeah, as soon as they spoiled this card, I noticed that the 2-headed coins on Star City Games went up to like $1,300 and totally sold out.
Nice. And that totally makes sense, because I would definitely see people taking advantage. But I think he's vintage playable.
I think he's at odds with Jace just because of the mana cost, which sucks, but he seems effective. I like Bolt on a dude.
Untaps Time Vault. Doesn't search for it, but...
No, he doesn't quite do everything with Time Vault like Tezzeret does, but being able to combo infinitely with Time Vault is pretty good. And I think the blue-red combination is sort of interesting because thinking of that automatically puts me in like a control slaver mindset, and I wouldn't mind seeing him untapping welders to take an extra weld. I mean, the welding ability is really strong, and you could also potentially untap Bazaar to go with your weld.
Or you could untap something
and
like Mana Vault.
I have some really awesome Bazaars.
There you go.
I've heard about those.
Hand drawn for me.
Yep. That's right, they got shipped across the country. I think he's got some potential. I mean, I definitely think he'll get tested and somebody will probably find a home for him.
And he's sexy.
And he's sexy.
And apparently feeling himself up in his sexiness.
Yeah.
You know, I'm never going to be able to look at that card and not think about that.
Yeah, no
Thanks,
kidding.
Guys.
So what do we think about the flipping 5 coins ability? Is that good? Is that bad? I mean, I suppose you would take an average of 2.5 turns, right?
Right.
It's okay. I think that you're probably going to get, honestly, better mileage out of using his Bolt ability 3 times.
Right. Well, I mean, you have to think, in the time that he uses his +7 ability, let's say that he does get 2 extra turns, you know, he goes from, you know, figure he started at 8, goes down to 1, and then he would go back up to 3.
Woot.
Is that good?
I don't think that's good enough.
I mean, like, I just said that out loud and I was disappointed. So.
Yeah, I actually was at first thinking that it was 7 coins, which I'd be more prone to, but at 5, it seems pretty sour.
Because taking 2 extra turns isn't good enough for Jeff.
Well, no, I mean, you spent at least 3 turns getting him up there.
Yeah.
I mean, at that point, you're almost winning more, right? I mean, like, even Jace's ability is like, by the time you're to like -9, or to 9 counters on Jace, like you've pretty much already won.
Right. Well, that's the thing. It's like all of the Planeswalker's ultimate abilities are supposed to effectively win the game. Does this one effectively win the game? If you take 2 extra turns, does that win the game? I mean, that's pretty good.
You could have just played Pyromancer Ascension and cast Time Walk, though.
No, because we're playing vintage.
Yeah.
More importantly, though, we're magic players. We like to accessorize. So don't give me a sexy planeswalker that wants me to flip a coin, and then not give me a coin.
Yeah.
Oh, that's
true.
They
should include coins.
Are there any?
Bring a coin. That would be awesome.
They never have released like an official Magic the Gathering coin to flip.
That's,
I know.
Like,
I mean, why kind of bullcrap is that? Like, if you want me to flip a coin, give me a coin. I want a two-sided angel coin.
Yeah, you're definitely going to rouse their coin, though. Like, it's his head on one and his butt on the other.
Yeah.
Do better, wizards.
If we want them to do better, they just need to stop printing so many creatures.
Yeah.
Way too many creatures.
Well, they just need to stop making creatures that cost so much for what they do.
Yeah, that's
true.
Did you see, I know that card, the new, I don't know how you say, is it Thesa?
The tenth chick? No.
Yeah.
Tessia, like, Envoy of Ghosts?
Yeah, her.
Oh, her.
A lot of people were saying they wish she was, four to cost and 1/1. They were saying that would be much better than having her be 7 for 4/4.
I know that I would never pay 4 mana for a 1/1.
Well, I think the thing is, Tessa currently costs 7, so...
Keep in mind though that all these cards are made for standard and limited. Like they don't really think about us when they're designing cards.
Right.
Like I would say that the last actual card that was specifically designed for vintage was in World Wake, because I forget who the lead designer of that set was, but I remember him saying in an interview that Lodestone and Nature's Claim were both specifically designed for the format. And obviously none of the designers since then have even, like, taken any of that into consideration.
I mean, Rest in Peace is really close.
Yeah, Rest in Peace is an eternal card. I mean, that's...
And if it makes you feel any better, I tweet just about everybody at Wizards every other day to tinker me an angel.
Yeah.
Yeah, you got Platinum Angel. That's pretty good.
Listen, I have one angel. You know, I say that. I say tinker me an angel, and all of Twitter replies, you have Platinum Angel. I'm like, okay, who you have? Like, I mean, I can only have one artifact angel? Forget
and it's
you.
A 4/4. Come on, that's terrible. It needs to be at least a 7/7.
I think even if it is a 7/7, I still think that Inkwell's probably better, because at least it can't get bounced.
No, we're not doing ticker targets right now.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's still a long way to go on the Dragon Maze spoilers. I mean, do we
know what percentage have been spoiled so far?
From what I have, we're at 55 out of 166, so we're a third of the way there. There are some interesting cards that we've seen, so there could be some more. I mean, my favorite are always the uncommons that come out, so I always wait for those.
It's usually the best cards in the set anyway.
Yeah.
You can't have a Snapcaster in every set.
Thank God.
It'd be nice if it did. But anyway, you know, the reason we had Joe and Heather on was to talk about building a vintage community, and I think there's actually a lot of potential for vintage right now. There's, I think Twitter has for some reason become this great place to find and talk about vintage. Because I think there are a lot of players who are sort of out in the wilderness, vintage speaking, and they don't really have a play group that wants to play.
We're here for you, homies.
Yeah, exactly. Like, there are a bunch of vintage people who can get together and talk on vintage and, you know, help each other find opponents and that sort of thing. And, you know, I think it's really ended up being a pretty good help. You know, there's still a matter of actually getting a group of people together so that you have, you know, an 8 or more person tournament semi-regularly.
Joe's been really good at that, though, here. He's done a great job sparking vintage in Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
I've been trying, like, my first initial pushes for the format were pretty good, but it's, let me explain a little bit, like, Eternal formats in general in Vegas are not very popular. We have a lot of really competitive players here, even though our community is very small. Like, I would say the Magic community as a whole is maybe 100 players. That's not really a lot for a city that has 2 million residents. And that's not taking into account, like, all super kitchen table,
right,
and et cetera. So
how many players does David Williams count for?
What? Dave's kind of his own like his own polarity. Like, he has a handful of players that gravitate towards him. You know, him and Eric Froelich are both into vintage, so like they do their own drafts and things like that. And they don't really come out very much except to things like pre-release PTQs, and occasionally when we have vintage, they will come if he's in town. But with the World Series of Poker coming, there will be less of those guys being around because it's money time. Right. But so anyway, we don't have very much of an eternal community. I would say there's maybe 20 total legacy players in town, and only 8 of those people have all the cards. And since a lot of those cards translate over into vintage, it's really hard to get new players attracted to a format where the first thing that they think is, wow, this is really, really expensive. And it becomes really daunting. It becomes really daunting immediately.
Right.
So it was a challenge. Like it's still a challenge to even get people who normally come to show up to the events. And I know that there are a lot of people out there, especially in Europe, who are not proponents of proxies, but without them, our scene would not exist.
Yeah, that's...
I agree. It would absolutely not exist.
That's pretty much how it is in the United States. Like, it would just be... I mean, we actually have a lot of power players in Cleveland, and or at least semi-powered, and some people are acquiring power, but it
doesn't even have to be necessarily power that's the barrier because,
right.
I mean, like, you know, I have, a decent presence on Twitter and lots of friends that trade. I mean, you know, Medine is my boss. So, right. Like, but I mean, it still took me 3 months to get Vendillion clicks. Like, I mean, because I wanted to trade for them. Like, I didn't want, I mean, yeah, I could afford to just go plop down $40 or $45 or whatever.
Right.
But, and I don't know, okay, Star City Games has them at like, I think like $44, $45. That's a lot. Nobody, right. And I mean nobody, is trading their clicks anywhere close to $50.
Right.
Like, they just won't. Like, they just, they keep them. They just look at you like you're asking for a foil Jace the Mind Sculptor. And you're like, right. Bro.
Yeah. And
I'm offering you like $60 in trade here. Like, really? Give me a click.
And that's actually a really interesting thing too, is that there are cards like that because of Modern and because of Wizards' push for Modern.
Yeah.
That those cards are really popular. Those, like, it is actually, like, as a trader, like, I don't really trade as much anymore. Like, I just kind of settled down at the beginning of the year to pursue other things. But, like, as a trader, I always, like, I could get you an literal unlimited amount of Underground Seas if you needed them. But right now I could maybe get you 2 Vendillion clicks. Like, yeah. I know no one who has them for trade, or no one that's even willing to trade them.
Yeah.
So it's very daunting. The other thing with the players in Vegas too is they seem to get like fairly frustrated when trying to trade for older stuff, because I mean, you know how it is. Most people break into Magic through drafting, through Standard, and then they discover these old formats, and the traders out there aren't exactly willing to let go of their eternal cards.
Well, a lot of people aren't even prepared to get, I mean, to get rid of them. They don't have them necessarily. They don't have them on hand. They might have them in a box somewhere, but it's not like
I know.
It's really hard for the newer players to understand how come their Standard card that's like $35 now isn't equal value to a library, even if you're trading like,
right.
I mean, they just don't, they don't get, you need a lot of that card to equal the value of, you know what I mean?
There's definitely a premium on older cards once you get down to actually trading for them.
The library is appreciating, right. Whereas Standard cards are inevitably depreciating in most cases, because once they rotate out of Standard, a lot of their value goes away unless they're like heavily played in Modern or Legacy.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the reasons when Joe, I saw how hard he was trying to build the community here, and like vintage just really appealed to me and my lifestyle and my availability and, you know, just everything about it. So that's one of the reasons I just said to heck with it. All you proxy haters, we're going to proxy the world. I don't give a damn. we're going to play vintage and ball out. We're going to have fun. So, you know, you sit there and pout at home.
Right. No, I was saying a while ago that, you know, proxies are actually an interesting way to get people into vintage, because I know there have been a few people on Twitter and elsewhere who've come up with pretty interesting, like, themes for their proxies, and that sort of thing where it's just like, you know, they're really putting the time and effort into these proxies, which are now cards that they really want to play all the time. So
that is actually something that's happened here too, where we had a lot of people proxy their decks, and I know that a lot of places like Northeast Vintage and stuff, like, they have pretty strict rules because of their prize structures and stuff about, you know, how many proxies you're allowed to have and how they're supposed to be done. I loosened up a bit on that here because I wanted it to be more casual so people would come and play, you know, like, cheaper buy-ins. So it was more like vintage FNM, you know, where it's like $5, $10, and, you know, you get paid in store credit. And a lot of the people who are actually doing well were using that money to buy the cards that they didn't have.
Yeah.
That was actually really good. Like, it gives you some appreciation for the format by having ownership in the format. It helps out your local shops. It gives you a reason, like, when you have, like, even if you have small cards like Brainstorms and some Ponders, you know, like cheaper good combo pieces like Yawgmoth's Bargain and stuff, you know, $2 and $3 cards, as you accumulate those, it makes you want to trade the stuff that you're not using to get the better cards in your decks, right. You know.
Well, I know I've talked to store owners before who've said that, you know, having vintage in the store really helps because they move cards that they wouldn't necessarily, that people wouldn't necessarily have other interest in. So, I mean, like those Yawgmoth Bargains and things like that where it's just like, you know, you're going to come in looking for that unless they're playing vintage.
Yeah, and that happens here too. We actually, a lot of the shops in town don't really, like, they won't give you a decent trade value on your eternal cards when you're trying to trade them in, and it's because of that, like, they have trouble moving them.
Yeah, they can't.
And a lot of vintage-specific cards aren't, like Yawgmoth's Bargain is not legal in EDH, you know, so the cards never move out of the bulk boxes and things like that. So mine and Heather's local game store, like, whenever someone comes in and buys a card like that, or when they buy a card like Wheel of Fortune, they're just like, oh, wow, you know, and they ask, they're like, why are you buying this? And it's like, oh, so I can, you know, so I have the real card for so-and-so vintage event. And it's really helped. And I was reading somewhere on the Mana Drain, like, I think I was going through an old forum, and someone was complaining about proxies. And I think it was someone from Europe. And what people don't understand also is that, like, Europe is, like, the size of the East Coast.
Yeah.
Like, it's pretty small. Like, at least all the places that you would travel to a relative vintage tournament. So and trading is easier. Yeah, exactly. Like, you're, like, traveling is really easy there. You know, like, you have more traders, you have more shops that you can go to. You just have more access to cards than you do in the U.S. Like, everything we do here is mail order.
Right.
You know, like, you're not going to be able to trade for power every week because I'm not going to take a train to Ohio on a Friday, you know, to go play in that weekend's vintage tournament. It's just not feasible. Like, the United States is huge and all the cities are spread out, so we don't have the same communities that they do over there. So it makes it a lot tougher to bring people together to play the format.
In general, there are sort of a lot of complications in comparing the European scene to the North American scene in talking about proxies. I mean, it's not just the distance. It's a lot of things.
Oh yeah, like, just the logistics part of it is atrocious. Like, if you think about it, like, I saw Steve Menendian on Twitter mention something about someone wanting to do a Bizarre Moxon style vintage tournament in the United States. That would be wonderful.
Yeah, where do you even hold that, though?
That's a logistical question. Not only that, but you need to have enough advertising and enough advance notice for players to where they can actually plan to go to this because, like I said, you know, Bizarre Moxon is in France and Annecy or however you pronounce it. So, you know, if I'm living in England and I see that this tournament's going on, I can just use my rail pass and hop on the train and it's 6 or 7 hours or however long it is and you're there.
You know, exactly.
And here you have to fly, and like flying is getting so expensive now. Like, there's so much more to it that I think that's the reason that Gen Con hasn't ballooned. You know, like 150, 200 is around, I think, the number of players that you guys get every year.
Yeah.
Also, as far as Gen Con is concerned, the prizes for Gen Con, I mean, the painting's cool, but the rest of it is like the worst.
Yeah,
you're gonna give me sorted packs where you know nothing good is in them? Like, get the out of here.
Yeah. I think that speaks to the lack of popularity for a big sanctioned tournament like Gen Con versus the Northeast Vintage Series, which I believe just ended recently after several years going, like 3 or 4 years going or something like that. And, they give away power and all kinds of things. And you would think that, having a large scale tournament like Gen Con would give, like, the painting's unbelievable. I mean, who would not want to have that on their wall? And from what I understand, if you want to sell them, they fetch a couple $1,000s, but if you win that, like, why on earth would you ever sell it?
Right.
You know, so there needs to be, like, for the people who aren't winning the painting, there needs to be some realistic prizes.
You don't want just a couple of packs of Italian Legends?
Well, no.
What else were they giving? They were giving M12 packs.
And see, even if you get the best pull out of Italian Legends, which I believe would be Tabernacle.
Yeah.
At the Italian version is like going for around 225 cash value in near mint condition, somewhere around there. Like, that's about the best pull you can hope for, and it's just too much of a gamble. So,
yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
I understand.
It's the old packs. You can push the rare to the top, and then
and see them. Yeah, you can actually.
Yeah.
You know, it's not going to be a Tabernacle.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, and then you got to try. And the other side of that too is if you do get those packs and you see that it's not a Tabernacle, people who buy from eBay are smart. So if you post you have these packs on eBay, they're going to be like, well, why are they selling these sealed packs? And anyone who knows anything about buying old packs knows that you can see what the cards are if you push them up high enough. So they just never really sell for the amount of money that you would want to get out of them anyway. So
Also the entry fee to Gen Con is prohibitive because it's basically $90.
Yeah, you have to register for Gen Con and then it's some number of tickets to actually be in the event. So
it's not just paying your money.
Right, it's not just a $20 tournament or even a, $40 or $50 tournament.
Yeah, see, that's really, I mean, granted, you get to enjoy the rest of Gen Con also, and according to Medina, there's some weird hentai bar there that...
Oh,
there's actually no nudity, we didn't go.
Oh, okay, I was like, when I heard about that, I was like, I must see this. But anyway,
no.
Back to the...
Don't.
But anyway, back to the point, we don't have the same logistical convenience in the United States that they do in Europe. And the guys who run Bazaar of Moxen are amazing at getting the prizes together. Like, the prizes they give away for that tournament are unbelievable.
Right.
Power duels, I think first place of, or second place of, the vintage event last year got a set of 40 duels or something. The prizes were just insane. And then they had a giveaway prize that was four Sandrine altered underground seas, which looked incredible. They were absolutely incredible looking. And we just don't have that kind of support here yet. And it'll take a while, but going back to the original point of the local scenes, getting people interested is not that hard. People shy away from the format, and I know you guys have covered it several times, in this podcast, so many insane plays where people watch the games and their minds are blown by the sheer amount of plays. It can get confusing, and the only way to get people involved when they feel like that is to put a deck in their hands and say, let's play a few games. And I did that, not necessarily doing that, but I have a friend here, and Heather's played against him. His name is Drake. And when I first got into the format, I talked to him, and I was like, hey, man, I was like, I want to try this out, so do you mind printing out a deck, and let's play some games? And he did it, and it was just... instantly fell in love, and more and more players followed, and it was literally just that. So I actually have a bit of a new plan. The World Series of Poker is about to start here for people who are interested in that. There's 60 days worth of events, et cetera, et cetera. Well, I'm a poker dealer, so I get stuck working that entire time with no days off. So my vintage exposure will be limited during that time, but after, by the time that's over, I plan on having maybe a dozen or so decks proxied, the most popular decks in the format, various versions of workshops, blue decks, Burning Long, Belcher, just a very broad spectrum of decks. So when we have a tournament, if someone's there and they're like, oh, you know what, maybe I'll play, I don't really have a deck, I'll just open a box and be like, choose your weapon.
Yeah.
You know, and we've had a couple tournaments where we've had guys play who borrowed decks from another buddy of mine who has several decks proxied, never played a game of Vintage in their life. And they're like, yeah, I'll play it for $5, you know, does anybody have an extra deck? And, you know, someone passes them a deck. And I've heard it so many times at our tournaments where people are like, this is the most fun I've ever had playing Magic. Just in the fact that the amount of crazy plays that I've seen, just like my mind is absolutely blown at this format. And
well, it's really sweet to cast spells that are appropriately costed.
I like how Vintage is now defining what appropriate cost is.
I mean, that's when it started, right?
That's right. Well, it's interesting because the store in Sandusky where we had the tournaments actually asked for a list of Vintage decks that they could proxy out, and I assume they're doing, you know, you print out 75 cards and put them in lands with sleeves, or in sleeves with lands. And those, again, those would be used to loan out to people who want to play them in tournaments or to try them out during the store during the day. So,
and that,
I think that's a pretty good strategy. Like being able to accommodate extra players who are, you know, curious but not really into the format yet.
It's an excellent idea for the shop to get involved, especially if they're going to be holding the tournaments, because even if you get one random player who comes in and is like, oh, do you have any Magic going on today? Yeah, we do. We're about to start, you know, this $10 Vintage tournament. It goes on all this, and they're just like, oh, man, I can't play. I don't have a deck. Not to worry, my friend. Here you go. Like, you know, you can let them look through the deck, see which one would appeal to them. And to be fair, people are afraid to jump right in with no knowledge of what's happening. So it helps, too, when someone from the community is like, oh, hey, you're new. You know, this is kind of what you can expect. Please do not get discouraged.
Right.
If you just tell someone, just don't get discouraged, because this format, it's incredible. Like, you're going to see the craziest stuff happen. And just think of it as like, don't think of it as like, that's crazy, I don't want to be involved. Think of it as like, I can do that too.
Right.
Because, well, I think I read a tournament report that Lou Christopher wrote, and it was a while ago, but he was playing Burning Long, and I think his opponent was like brand new to Vintage, and I think he like beat him, and then he was like, hey, you know, do you want to play some more games? And then like, you can show me your hand, and I'll show you like kind of what you should do.
Yep,
like,
that is
what Vintage needs.
Yeah, that did actually happen. It was a young kid that plays, he's mostly a casual player, and he does play some Standard, but he'll play Vintage with us if someone has a deck for him, because he's only like 14 years old. He came and he was just hanging out at the shop, and we're like, hey, Alex, do you want to play a Vintage tournament? And he's like, I don't have a deck. We handed him one, and he was just ecstatic the whole time. He's like, for days and days, he's like, this is the most fun I've ever had. And he would just sit down and he would watch us play, and we'd give him decks and he'd play some games. And, you know, it's like everyone who's brand new to the game, they don't know all the cards, like, cause every deck has 31 ofs in it outside of workshops. So, you know, they don't know everything that's happening, but they're sitting there and they're learning. And that is, that's what I see, that it's bringing people back.
Right. Well, Jeff, but, you ran into somebody new at the most recent Team Serious.
Yeah, the recent TSO, we had 9 people, one of which was a first timer from Sandusky, and he was playing some kind of,
Actually, that he was from Sandusky is pretty good, because we've, historically gotten pretty poor turnout from the host city itself.
Like, yeah.
People come up from Columbus, you come from Cleveland, Jeff comes from Toledo, Michigan. But like, getting people to play in from Sandusky is a pretty big deal, so I'm happy that he started there and hopefully he comes back.
Yeah, he was playing some kind of green, black, heavily land destruction deck. It was really blowing some of our minds. He didn't do very well, but I know that he had us on the ropes pretty well with a combination of zany things like Penumbra Spider and Royal Assassin, in addition to
Helldozer,
like,
right?
Yeah, and Helldozer rocked my world. But the store owner at the Hero Zone gave him those printouts of decks, and he was just sort of looking at him, and he said next time he's going to come back, be more prepared. He'll either have a different version of the deck that he brought, or a little bit tweaked version of one of the lists that he gave him. But, I mean, he seemed interested in the format. I talked to him for a little while, and, I mean, I was just psyched that he saw that the tournament was happening, was like, oh, I can come to this and see how it goes.
What, do you know what he normally plays?
I don't, but he was playing, I mean, his deck was entirely, it was zero proxy, and he was playing things like,
Sinkhole.
Yeah, he was playing things like Sinkhole, so I get the feeling that he's been around.
Right. It's sort of interesting, because you get, I mean, vintage players can sort of come from a lot of different places. I mean, you get the kitchen table gamers who have been playing for 20 years at this point. You get legacy players who have the mana base and the Force of Wills and some of the other cards available to them. You get EDH players who have, they're sort of used to playing this Highlander format where, you know, they're playing pretty powerful cards and they maybe want a more competitive or a more one-on-one format or just interest in, you know, playing in a different environment. And, you know, there's a lot of players that a lot of people who come from different places.
I think there's a real misconception too that you can't play with cards that you like from standard too, because like when I started, you know, almost in my opinion, all the best angels have been printed since Baneslayer on.
Right.
And I wanted to play with Entreat the Angels. That was poor Joe. And you know, but what was hilarious was when the first time I brought it to the shop and like I would play, like Joe knew what I had, but nobody else did. And so I would, you know, miracle the Entreat the Angels and my opponent would just be looking at me like, what the just happened here? What do I even do with this card? Like I have all these things and then they do nothing. Yeah, but I mean, obviously that didn't work out as well as I planned. So then I had to go to the experts to build me, my vintage restoration deck.
I like that you consider me an expert.
You are an expert. You're my vintage guru.
Restoration Angel costs 4, Nat. You know about that.
Yeah, it doesn't cost 3 though. It doesn't cost 3.
I think that in general, I mean, vintage, I mean, it can be a good place for, I mean, the foundation of Ohio style is playing what you want.
Right.
Working that into the format. I mean, that can be satisfying, fun, good for everyone involved.
Right.
And Eternal Magic, it talk about like these people that just like own these cards that come out of the woodwork. If you go to any major legacy event and you pick out the people over 40, one of those dudes is playing lands, and he has every single card, and he's had all of them since they came out. Yep. He's playing lands forever, and he has like a $5,000 deck.
Hey, yeah. I remember when Tabernacle was a $1 card.
This card is terrible. Why would you play it? It kills all your creatures. Jeez.
I actually remember, and I obviously I regret this now because I own a set of Bazaars, but I remember when Bazaar was unplayable.
Oh yeah, it's card disadvantage.
It still is. It's card disadvantage.
The game certainly has changed and vintage has changed, and just the power level, like obviously the power level of the cards that we have from back then are insane. Like, anyone who plays Legacy and has never played Vintage who thinks that Brainstorm shouldn't be banned is dumb. they've obviously just become too set in their ways. Like, and I'll be honest, I was one of those guys. Like, I play a lot of combo in Legacy as well. Like, I play decks like ANT and TES. Like, I've played a fair amount of High Tide. When I started playing Vintage, I had realized that Brainstorm was restricted. I was like, alright, this doesn't seem that bad. Until I cast my first Brainstorm in Vintage and I was like, this card is ridiculous. Like, it gave me an entirely new outlook on the card itself. And
Brainstorm is ridiculous in Legacy.
Yeah, and that's the point I'm getting to is that, like, I hear people at these events complain that cards like Mystical Tutor are banned. Like, Mystical Tutor should absolutely be banned. Like, that card should never be unbanned in Legacy. Because if you have 4 Brainstorm, 4 Ponder, and 4 Preordain, and now 4 Gitaxian Probe in a lot of the combo decks that people are playing, that is just a ridiculous amount of redundancy. Right. Now, think about why these cards were restricted in Vintage. Like, the long deck had the most ridiculous turn 1 win percentage in history of any deck, like, since the original 4 Academy builds of, like, the 90s, like, 1999. Like, there is a reason that those cards are restricted in this format, and the power level of Legacy is obviously not as powerful, but when you put 4 Brainstorm and 4 Ponder in the same deck, like, you just have an insane amount of consistency, and it really gives you, like, playing those cards in Vintage and having them restricted really gives you some insight into why those cards are so powerful.
Right.
Yeah, Brainstorm is really good.
Yeah, especially when it's attached to a guy that just ends the game. And people wonder why is, they're like, why is he $150? I'm like, have you played Jace the Mind Sculptor? Really? Like, I mean, he's obviously a Legacy staple, but he doesn't see the same amount of play as he does in Vintage and as he did when he was legal in Standard.
Right? He's okay.
It's a 4-drop. What are you going to do?
4-drop. Unplayable.
Turn 1 landmarks, go. Mana drain your guy. Play my Jace. Game over. And I understand why the community as a whole is afraid of cards like those in Vintage, but people who are thinking of trying the format, you shouldn't be discouraged because whatever you see your opponent doing, you can do all those things. You can do all those things. And sometimes you can do them better and faster. And it is so satisfying to turn 1 Jace a workshop opponent because they just look at you like, they just get the sigh. And they're like, yeah, okay. And especially if they're not turn 1-ing Lodestone Golem.
Well, it's funny because Vintage, I mean, you really do the same things that you would normally do in a Standard game. You just do them in fewer turns. I mean,
absolutely.
You still have this period of, you know, establishing a base, either mana base or, you know, creature base, that sort of thing. And then you have this mid game where you're struggling with your opponent to gain control. And then you have this end game where you're figuring out how to put your opponent away. What's the best way to do that? You know, everything still happens. It's all still Magic the Gathering that goes on. It's just, but it happens in a different way. And
you just get to play with the most broken versions of those spells. Like that. That's why I can't remember what the gentleman's name was that won Gen Con this last year with
Mark Lanegra.
Yeah, Mark Lanegra, when he won it with the Grixis deck. That deck, when I first saw it, because it had started posting results in Europe before Gen Con, and then he came over and won with the deck. I was really excited to see that deck because it was a control deck that I felt like Eternal players and even Standard players who are used to playing decks that are like more control-y could get behind because it was a deck that, yeah, it has fast mana and it has card advantage, but you get to establish games the same way that you do in a less powerful format, but you still have like the bombs in there, like Time Vault, Tinker, etc. And I was really excited to see that deck because it kind of opened the way for especially a few of the locals to see the deck and be like, yeah, I could play that. And the same thing with Mike Solomossi's deck, the Rug Delver deck. It was the same thing. We had a handful of players who started in the format on that deck because it was something that they could get behind because they were familiar with how it played. And Vintage has really been going in a way that I think that players can get behind as long as there's someone there to help them realize that cards like Demonic Tutor are broken, but you get to play them too.
Right. Well, Heather, how did you come into Vintage? I mean, you said earlier that Vintage fit your lifestyle. What do you mean by that? Why did Vintage appeal to you?
Well, I tried initially when I got back into Magic to play at FNM and, you know, Standard and all that jazz, but Standard now is absolutely nothing like Standard was in, you know, 2000, 2001. Like, it's just, it's not even close to feasible. And, you know, when you work in the casinos, your schedule is so bizarre. And so I don't have, like, a lot of Friday nights off and then, so I saw Joe, you know, tweeting like, I was watching him for a while and he would tweet every like couple months. He'd be like, having a Vintage tournament, you know, come on down. And I was like, you know, I can do every couple months.
Yeah.
And more importantly, I can do a deck that I just get to play forever. You know what I mean?
Right.
I don't have to fight with the Standard crowd and the value traders.
Right. Well, I know a big part of Vintage is that it doesn't have, I mean, a lot of the vintage crowd is a little bit older. I mean, you're looking at people who are in their mid to late 20s and beyond.
That really appealed to me too.
Yeah, and it, you know, you have this more sort of level-headed community. They're not quite as dramatic as a high school or college-based community would be.
I mean, we were talking about Mike Salamasi earlier.
Right. Okay, so there's some.
Let's just leave Sally out of this.
And I'm sure, you know, at especially some of the European where you're playing for big money or like at Gen Con where it's like, I'm sure people get serious and tilt, but for the most part, like, I think vintage everywhere is just pretty casual and pretty, like, you know, people aren't just like freaking out.
No, they want to see all the things happen.
Right.
Even if it's happening to them.
You know what was really cool though about the very first time I went was when Joe threw a tournament and like a little mini tournament. He was like, hey, just come on down. We're going to get together. It's just informal, nothing crazy. So I had that night off and I went down and it was hilarious because the vintage, we had one table and we were in the back and everybody was playing F&M and like between rounds they would come and they would like, it was like we were part of the Godfather crew. They would come.
Yeah,
they'd
come watch.
Come watch and like peek over their shoulders like, wow, that part's so cool. And then, it was hilarious because I sucked so bad. I had not played Magic in so long. And Joe was like sitting right beside me and he's like, nope, nope, can't cast that. Nope. Your fetch land, you actually have to fetch a land. he was like over my shoulder, he's like, nope, nope. but everybody I played was, they were super great.
Yeah.
I can tell you though that, that my buddy Drake was really, surprised by the fact that he couldn't beat a 4/4 angel token.
It's true. What do you do about that?
He had that, like, I was sitting there watching the game and she popped an entry for one and he just looked and he's like, oh man. He's like, I don't think I can beat that. And I'm just sitting there kind of laughing in the background. I'm like, yeah, that, a 4/4 flyer, like, there's a reason that the deck, the original deck was so powerful for so long.
Right.
Four flyers are tough to beat in the format.
Well, speaking about the original deck, I mean, Vintage sort of also has a slower pace. I mean, you don't really need to, I mean, Heather talked about, you know, not being able to play every week. Like, you can still keep up with the format because it doesn't change that quickly. You know, when new sets come out, you might have to adjust to one or two new cards.
Yeah, I really, really like that. That you only have to get, you know, you don't have to get a complete play set of every card in every, all the things. You just need, you know what I mean? There's just like, you know, maybe three or four cards that are going to be good or, that you might even want in your deck. And then you just get those and you're set forever.
Yeah, yeah. I think that makes a big difference to a lot of players because you really don't have to, there's not as much pressure on you to keep up.
Additionally, the cards that you want to get are often not the expensive cards.
Right.
It's like typical uncommons or even commons. There aren't a whole lot of chase rares that are applicable in Vintage. Obviously there are exceptions, but I mean, I know that the last dozen cards that I've gotten from current sets have probably not been owed more than $1 a piece.
Yeah. I feel like when a new set comes out, I spend $20 and that's most of what I want.
Yeah.
The other good thing too that should appeal to players is, I know that there's always a lot of controversy surrounding the restricted list, but having to not worry about every ban cycle and something being banned or unbanned that just like throws the format into upheaval is really, really, it's really good. I personally feel like, I mean, I would still consider myself a very new player because I've only been playing around a year, as far as Vintage is concerned, but I love the restricted list. I love everything about it. I don't necessarily agree with every single card on it. That's a discussion for a different time, but I love the fact that it exists.
Yeah.
And after playing Legacy forever and ever and playing, like, cause I started playing around Ice Age. I played during Black Summer. I played during Combo Winter. You know, I played all those decks and, like, when you have consistency through redundancy, I mean, it's still Magic, so it's still fun, but it's not as fun. Yeah, it's not as fun as thinking about, all right, I have this Vampiric Tutor in my deck, and I'm looking at the board state, and I have 31 of's that I can go get. What is the best card for me to possibly get?
And no, then that is the worst. That is so hard.
That's the best.
No, that is so hard. I can't tell you how many times I have to, I'll be like texting Joe or Justin and I'll be like, I don't know what card to get.
That's
like,
why you play gifts and get them all.
I don't know what to do. I'm like, I have like 20 cards I could get and I have no, I'm like, oh, and then I'm like, eventually I'm just, you know, like any mini miny mo in my head.
That's what's appealing about the format to me. It's like, the format is essentially a puzzle, and the more pieces you add to the puzzle, it's like, what's harder to put together, a 20,000 piece puzzle or a 5,000 piece puzzle?
Obviously, the decision tree, man.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, obviously, well, the 20,000 piece puzzle.
Especially with my deck that my guru built me, because like when you have like half your deck in your graveyard and you're about to put down a Snapcaster, it's like, oh my gosh.
Start with Ancestral Recolor Timewalk.
Like,
And then the best thing.
Yeah, you're only playing blue and white too. You're not even playing black, so you don't even have to factor Yawgmoth's Will into that.
Yeah, no.
And the best thing is you can draw and you're drawing dead and you draw like a fetch land and you put your card down on the table and then you pick up your graveyard and look at it and your opponent's like, you drew a Snapcaster Mage.
And that's what's so intriguing to me about the format is that it's literally, you could spend your entire life playing this format and you'll never have every playdown because there's just too much happening. And when your opponent has as many cards in their hand as you do, like, you can't, it's not like Legacy. Like, when I'm playing Legacy, like, I play a lot of, like I said, I play a lot of TES, and which I know, like, guys like Jacob, Kobe, Corey can get behind. Like, it's pretty easy to tell what someone has in their hand by the lines of play that they're making. Not so much in Vintage. Like, you can kind of get a handle on blue players, like, if you have a decent idea of what's in their deck, like, you can tell if they have a drain in their hand or maybe a force, and then you can deduce from there, but still, like, you know, you're at best like 60% at guessing what they have in their hand.
Right.
And you just get to make these plays, and when you have all these one-ups, it just opens up so many more avenues and there's so many more roads that you can take. And it makes for a more interesting game of Magic, in my opinion.
Well, that's part of it. I mean, like, the Vintage metagame right now is fairly open. I mean, like, you can do a lot of different things. I mean, we have a good combo deck in Burning Long, we have all the way down to a good blue control deck in Landstill, Bomberman, that sort of thing. You have everything in between. And even with the shop decks, there's several different variants that happen. So it's not like, there's a lot of different things that are good right now and can win a tournament on any given day.
Absolutely. Like, you can just check, and people ask me occasionally, like, where I go to look at the results, and I just tell them to go to morphling.de, and, like, if you just look at the metagames around the world, like, there's a different deck in every tournament that's winning. Like, I mean, you see your popular choices, you know, various workshops, Dredge, Burning Long is obviously the up-and-coming, like, the up-and-coming deck with the Unrestriction of Burning Wish. But now you have, like, the Tezzeret decks are coming back, the Tezzeret Grim Monolith decks. Doomsday has been making a comeback, I've seen, in the Midwest. There's so much that you can be doing. I can't remember what his name was. It just won your guys' tournament with Belcher. Like, that just goes to show you. Yeah, that goes to show you that's still a deck. And, like, even I see that there's Elves list popping up in your area occasionally. Like,
Ohio. Ohio tournaments are purely Ohio style.
but still, it doesn't matter if it's Ohio style. If it's on there and it can be there for someone to see, someone might play it somewhere else and it might spread. Like, there's no reason that people shouldn't try something different.
Yeah.
But,
well, so what kind of tactical things are you doing to get people into Vintage? I mean, like, I know in Columbus, like, a lot of it ends up coming down to talking to people individually and being like, hey, come on out and, you know, play with us, and I can let you borrow a deck. And
I actually do quite a bit of that. There are actually people in Vegas who have a lot more influence with the local player base than I do, even though I know pretty much everyone, but I don't, it's probably kind of bad that I do this, but I distance myself a little bit from the community as a whole because of the way the community is in Vegas. So I talk to friends of mine that are, you know, in with more of like the standard crowd and the draft crowd and stuff, and I get the word out that way. We actually have a local Las Vegas Magic Players page that has a few hundred members from all over Vegas, even parts of California and stuff. Yeah, we do. We do. But, I'll talk to you more about that after, Heather. I make posts in there, and I'm pretty close with a couple of the local shop owners, so I'll put out flyers and stuff like that when I actually have the opportunity to make them and get the word out that way. So it's a lot of little things that help get the players. But to be fair, like, for as much as I've done in the past year, like, I think once Heather started playing, like, her voice really spread the word of Vintage, at least worldwide, like, way more than I ever could have. Like, she did more in the span of a month than I felt like I had done in a whole year.
Wow.
Yeah, she tweets. She has a couple thousand followers. She tweets, and it just goes out everywhere.
Well, seems real strong. The world needs to know.
It is fun. You started, like, a whole trade movement in Europe. But, I guess my best advice is, to local players is if you want to do it, it'll take some time. It'll definitely take some time, but don't get discouraged and, try it. Like, if you can get one person that is willing to play and then is willing to help you, like I had, like, my friends helped out a lot. Like, my friends, I have to shout them out a little. Mm-hmm. My friends Drake and my friend Hunter, my buddy James, who Heather knows, and Heather herself.
Oh, okay, wait a minute. Hunter, wasn't he the one who had the only turn one kill, or was it turn two?
Yes, he was playing, he was playing Menendian's, the Rogue Hermit deck. And, he killed his opponent on turn one, and everyone was just like, it was just a wild moment.
It was fantastic, because it was my first Vintage, you know, experience, and like, all you hear about is Vintage, turn one kill, good game. You know what I mean? Like, that's like all you ever hear anybody can like say about it. And so like, I thought like I would go and like I would just always be dead, like turn one. And like, that didn't happen at like the whole tournament. I never like, you know, the games were going like so long. Well, especially my games. Then all of a sudden, like he starts doing stuff. And everybody stops, like, what they're doing, and they're just watching Hunter, and they're like, is he gonna do it? Is he gonna do it? It was pretty fantastic.
Yeah, my closest, to turn, I had a few turn two kills that tournament, but I did not get any turn ones, just for various reasons. That is also the truth also, and it's been said by these guys many times, is that Vintage is not as much of a turn one format as people want it to be.
Oh yeah.
A lot of people who don't know the format, they want it to be a turn one format, and that's just not the case. Like,
yeah. Well, I think that's part of it, is there's this stigma about Vintage that it's not only expensive, which proxies help with that a little bit, but
yeah.
it's super fast, it's unplayably fast for,
you know,
sitting down against someone when I'm just gonna, lose the coin flip and then lose on turn one.
Exactly. And, it does happen, but it's a fairly low percentage of the game. So don't be discouraged by that. I encourage people to use proxies because it's the fastest way to build a scene. And later on down the road when if you have people who are really, like really stoked on the format and they want to, they want to get more of the cards, then you can start, like, building more of a scene that's based on proxy rules, but...
Right. Well, that's part of it, is most people want to play with the real cards.
Yeah, I mean, out here we actually have weekly sanctioned Vintage.
Yeah.
Which I haven't played in a while because, well, my work and tax season and everything like that, but... Yeah, I mean, sanctioned Vintage is awesome because you play against so many weird things.
Yeah, that's what I actually started on sanctioned Vintage too. It wasn't that bad. Like I bought my horses and my dual lands and started from there. But
yeah, well, I mean, like there, like you could, like if you are into a deck like Landstill, like really all you need for that deck besides the dual lands and forces is like a library. You don't actually have to have the power. There are ways around it.
Yeah.
Like obviously, it makes your deck better, but.
Right.
I mean, it's playable without it,
Right.
They do Legacy. And the same with...
Mana Drain don't do that much for you.
Yeah, no, exactly. You don't need Mana Drain, you can play Counterspell in that spot,
right.
Like if you really want to play in a sanctioned Vintage tournament. And
right.
And you see a lot of that in Europe too with decks like White Trash and like the Hate Bears decks and stuff like that. You know, the guys, they want to play, so they get the cheapest pieces first, they build their decks and they're good to go until they, are either winning pieces or buying or trading for what they need.
Yeah, I think there's lots of ways to get into Vintage, and it's just nice to see that there are people out there who are trying to make it more popular and trying to talk to people and sort of demystify it a little bit, because I think that's a big part of it, right? Like, Heather obviously got a big Twitter presence, and I feel like she's done a pretty good job.
As long as Heather, like, cause she, like her, like, I only have around 90 followers or so, like, luckily for me, most of them are vintage related, but they're all people who are already established in the format.
Right.
Like Heather, like, I'm glad that Heather picked the format up because it really, it's gonna help give the format a voice because she just has such a broad appeal to players. And now that she's the
community manager,
the community manager for Legit, that's just going to give her even more of a voice. So that's really going to do a lot for the format as a whole. And I'm really glad that she's involved.
You know, a lot of people that hadn't really thought about Vintage as an option until I started tweeting or like posting proxies to make them jealous from the proxy guy. Or, you know, like when I said I wanted to start, you know, I got little gifts, little, you know, welcome to Vintage packages, and then, you know, Joe, like, there's so many Vintage players out there who have, like, pretty much, like, so many extra of, like, especially, like, the commons, like, the regular commons, uncommons, you know, and even some of the bigger stuff that'll just help you out. Like, it's just a great community. It's, like, way, way more helpful and, like, encouraging than some of the other, like, especially standard don't even get started.
Well, I feel like a lot of the Vintage players are pretty enthusiastic about the format, so it's just...
Like, they're just so excited. There's another person.
So happy that someone else is going to play. Like, hey!
Hello, you want to play Vintage with me? Please, sit down. Like, can I get you tea?
Yeah.
Welcome to Vintage. Good luck finding a tournament.
Yeah.
Well, we've pretty much solved the tournament issue here. We can't have them as often as I'd like, but we get them, and I'm able to schedule them here and there. And, it's really hard to schedule a Vintage tournament here around everything else that's happening.
Oh, yeah.
Because we have three major shops in town that run PTQs, ICQs for Star City Games, GPTs. There's just so much going on in Vegas, like, that's Magic related. So, it's really a chore to try to find a slot that works for everyone.
Right. But I also saw a rumor that, I guess maybe this is a good segue of there's going to be a Grand Prix Modern Masters Sealed. It's going to be in Las Vegas.
Yes.
I saw that there may be a Vintage side event there.
I'm currently talking with Damian Brunson, who is the owner of Tier 1 Games, about getting a Vintage side event. I don't have many details yet. It's still kind of like a grassroots type of thing, but, I'm trying to see what the limitations are as far as like, because it's at a Grand Prix, does it have to be sanctioned? You know, if it doesn't have to be sanctioned, like how many proxies can we get? Because the more proxies there, like, I know this sounds ridiculous, but the more proxies there are, the more people I know will play.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and not only that, but we'll have guys like David Williams and Eric Froelich, like guys who don't want to bring their $20,000 decks to the event site where, you know, there's going to be tons of people that you don't know, like lurking around and stuff. Like it would give them a way to, you know, get away from the riffraff and play.
Well, also the Grand Prix in Chicago Legacy that I went to in 2009, the reason that I went from Colorado is they actually did have a Vintage side event.
Mm-hmm.
On Sunday, and they allowed proxies. And I know this because that's when I played against Danny Friedman.
Huh.
He was playing Red-Green Goblin Welder, and he started game one with Proxy Taiga, Make Red, Cast Foil Japanese Goblin Welder.
That's awesome.
That's like definitely something that would happen around here.
That's a Vintage thing.
Yeah. Yep, I have these sweet Japanese foil cards that are worth more than your car, but I don't have any dual lands.
You don't have a Vendillion Click.
I'll definitely do what I can though, and I'll keep you guys updated as I get more information on
it. Yeah, that sounds good.
So if Vintage players are going to be coming out to Las Vegas, where might they be, you know,
eating?
Yeah.
Well, to be fair, Heather may actually know more about what's going on the Strip than I do, because I don't spend a lot of time there outside of work. The biggest obstacle is the fact that the event site is a couple miles north of downtown. It's at the Cashman Center,
It's by Old Vegas, because we got our hotel room off Fremont Street.
Yeah, it's definitely by Fremont Street.
Yeah, it's about a mile or so north of Fremont, so it's easily accessible by cab, and it won't be an expensive cab ride. Somebody gave me a reason why they didn't have it at one of the 200 more convenient places on the strip. I'm assuming that it's gambling related, because we have some strange laws here about technically games of variance. So I can see the reason for them having that, like, that far away. The closest place that I actually enjoy going to that is going to be near the Cashman Center. It's actually not too far from there. It's called Insert Coins. It's actually a video game bar.
Yes, it's fantastic.
And it is very, very cool. You'll actually probably see a lot of the Magic community there during that weekend, because it's, you can just go in, and they actually have a bar in there. Like, you can go in and drink, and you can play video games until your heart's content.
They have VIP booths where your booth has an Xbox so you can challenge your friends. You can get bottle service.
Yep. Wow. It is like a video game club, but it's reasonable. It's not really expensive or anything. It's actually quite a bit of fun. Asking where you can drink specifically, though, in Vegas is kind of redundant, because you can literally drink anywhere at any time. The only thing that you can't do, you can't have an alcoholic beverage outside anywhere except for Fremont Street and Las Vegas Boulevard from Stratosphere down to Mandalay. You can go into any casino, act like you're gambling on a machine, put 20 bucks in there, order a couple of drinks, cash out, and walk away. You could literally make an alcohol river in this town and just stick your face in it.
If you're planning your culinary adventures, I mean, there's like the obvious local favorites, which will be, you know, like you see all the pros tweeting about Lotus of Siam.
Yeah, if you follow LSV or David Williams.
Yeah, like they're going to be there. Like if they're in Vegas, they're going to be there. They're going to be eating there. But there's actually in the same shopping or like little area center that Lotus of Siam is another place called Kamal, and I actually think it's better. It's still Thai food, but I mean, it's just amazing. And they have, there's just so many places in town. It's like, it's so hard to like pick one, because there's so many like amazing chefs here, but there's a cute little place in, like if you're on the strip, there's a cute little place called Secret Pizza.
Oh, Secret Pizza is awesome. It's at Cosmopolitan.
Yes.
You have to go into the casino, and it's like down a hallway and down another hallway, and there's just like a door there. And it doesn't look like anything, but their pizza is really, really good.
It's really, really good. It's New York style pizza, and it's fantastic.
That sounds good.
There is one place that you should experience when you come. It's actually downtown also. It's called the Heart Attack Grill. I would not be surprised if the place isn't famous. Like, across the U.S. by now. It's actually owned by a doctor who
That guy died there?
It is actually owned by a doctor who I guess got tired of treating people who wouldn't take care of themselves. So he decided to open this restaurant. Their burgers are good. They do actually have good food there. If you're over, I believe it's 350 pounds, you get to eat for free.
Also, Joe, what's the name of that place the mayor opened where you can buy a girl with your steak?
I haven't been there yet.
On Fremont Street, since most of Magic will be on, I'll think of it eventually, but it's on Fremont Street, and it's a steakhouse that, Mayor Oscar Goodman opened, and you go in, and if you're alone, you can pay for a girl to sit with you while you eat.
Sounds like the ultimate admission of loneliness.
it's actually called Oscars. It's at the Plaza, which is at the very end.
Yes.
The Plaza Hotel and Casino is at the very end of Fremont
Street. You can
buy
a steak and a blonde.
Wow.
Oh, God. I have yet to eat there yet, but now I kind of want to go because it sounds good.
Oh, and since we're going to be on Fremont Street, you have to go to Main Street and pee on the Berlin Wall. The owner of Main Street, he bought a piece of the Berlin Wall and installed it in the men's restroom so you can actually go pee on the wall.
See, it's funny because my wife went to Vegas for work like a couple of weeks ago, and she was saying that it's like really bizarre because it's a place that is so extravagant and over the top that extravagant and over the top is just sort of like
it's par for the course, and you have to just sort of get wrapped up in that in order to appreciate, because the sheer absurdity of it, if you just talk about it in normal circumstances, like, what the f***?
One thing that you can say about Vegas is that if you've lived here, like, as long as Heather and I have, you, and especially in our jobs, like, I work in a casino, she works in a casino, and especially with her job, because she's a medic, you will see so much stuff that going anywhere else in the world won't seem dull.
Yeah.
Like, you come here and you stay for a while, and, like, you see tourists who are just like, I can't believe I'm looking at this. And you're just like, I don't understand what you're talking about. Like, what's wrong here? Like, it's very much like that. You become, I mean, it's fun, but it's kind of bad in a way that you really become desensitized to, all of the things. I mean, yeah, literally all of the things. Like, Halloween, if you have the opportunity to come to Halloween here, like, you will see the most bizarre and intense things you can imagine. And they're just another day. Like, it's...
Well, I was in Vegas a couple months ago, and it's the first time I've ever been there, and everything was like Jeff's wife said, it's just like, everything was so over the top that I was like, alright, I need to go to a normal bar.
Yeah. And there are no more normal bars. Like, the Griffin's fantastic. Bar. Yeah, the Griffin is a fantastic place. I really enjoy going there.
Our hotel that we got is 2 blocks away, and that's my deciding factor, is because it's so close to the Griffin.
I was gonna get to that, and I was gonna mention there, the Griffin and the Vanguard is also on the same block. Like, both of those are really good bars. Like, the Griffin especially is very laid back. It's very, like, it's kind of dark in there, but you can sit around and have a conversation, and it's not super loud. The drinks are really reasonably priced. The staff is really nice. If I personally were gonna hang out at any bar downtown, it would probably be there. Hmm. And it is because of all those factors. I've spent quite a bit of time there in my 7 or so years that I've lived in Vegas, and there's no other place I'd rather go if I was just looking for, like, a normal bar experience in a town that is just full of excess.
Yeah, I agree. The Griffin was awesome.
I'm not sure what... There's another place next door to Heather, you may know the name of it, but it's actually like a bar where they have shows and stuff.
The Beauty Bar?
Yeah, the Beauty Bar. Beauty Bar is actually really cool too. They have a lot of live music and stuff
a lot
there.
Of live music.
And yeah, and in the summertime, since it's going to be in the summer, the back will all be open and they'll probably have bands and stuff playing. Like, there's usually no cover, and like, the drinks are... They're fairly reasonably priced, but, like, what you're paying for extra in the drink is what you're paying for your entertainment. So that whole section of downtown, it's full of a lot of locals, like, a lot of, and especially Griffin Vanguard, a lot more people, like, mid-20s, you know, young professionals. You know, it's a good crowd. It's pretty laid back, and it's a good place to go when you're trying to escape, like, all the rest of the stuff that's happening. Because there will be, and especially with EDC, like, Electric Daisy Carnival being in town, you will... definitely not see any shortage of crazy. There will be plenty of crazy.
Oh, yeah, and as just a little, as your local PSA announcement here, you should not, absolutely not, during that weekend, take any drugs from anybody in a club, because all the drugs that come into town that weekend are, almost all of them are fake, or they're cut with really bad stuff, because they're just trying to pump out all the stuff for the EDC crowd, and they're just, and not only that, but they, like, double charge. Like, if you're gonna get a hit of X in, like, California for, like, $4, it's gonna be, like, $25.
Not, you know what only I mean? Like, will they be bad drugs, they'll be expensive.
Yes, just don't. Just leave it all alone that weekend.
Man, do I have to bleep this entire, like, 30-second segment right here? I think I might.
No, it's all good. I mean, we're not talking right
now. But
he's
saying,
don't do the drugs.
Yeah, that was a public service announcement.
Yeah.
If you've never been to Vegas before, definitely be mindful of your surroundings, especially if you're spending a lot of time downtown. Like, just don't be anywhere alone if you can help it. Like,
if you can help
it's,
it.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, it's just common sense. Like, I mean, Vegas is relatively safe for the type of town that we are.
Yes.
But there's just no reason to ever put yourself in a situation where something bad could happen to you.
Right.
So, you know, just, like, if you, like, most people are coming with friends, just stay in groups, you know, watch your wallet, like, put your wallet in your front pocket.
Like,
It's basic big city common sense stuff, you know.
Yeah, usual travel awareness.
Exactly. You know, it's just you need heightened awareness to live in or to visit a place like Vegas, because the money and the things like that, it attracts a lot of shady people, so.
Right. Speaking of which, you know, something I never knew about Vegas, but I think I learned from reading your article, Heather, was, don't pick up hoes in main Vegas.
Yeah, actually,
and that's
that
relevant for Magic players.
It is, yes, it is, because a lot of people we're in Nevada, we're gonna go get us a girl. You know what I mean? Like, it's super illegal. It's really not though, because you're in Clark County, and
Clark County is illegal.
And not only that, but like, I don't think most of the world understands, obviously, because they're not here. But let's say you have 100 people purchase a prostitute, right? Probably 88 of those people just get robbed. They don't actually get sex.
Yep.
So, the girls, they're giving you drinks and you're passing out or going to the shower and they're out with your watch and you're safe and you're...
Hey man, in every case, you get
if your goal is to get a prostitute, there'll be another Grand Prix Mexico City eventually.
Yes. Just don't. It's not legal. You can go to jail and worse. So.
You do not want to be in jail in Clark County.
No. That's an excellent point, Joe.
You do not want to be in jail here.
This is sir.
This is the most educational, serious food and drink we've ever had.
It really is.
Oh, and another thing too, if you're out drinking and having a good time, which I'm sure you will be, we encourage you to
have the best
time you can within, you know, without putting yourself in any danger. If you encounter a police officer, do not run your mouth at them. Because we have our police officers here, like, they're okay. But we have a very, very high instance of police shootings in Nevada.
Our homes don't play. go straight to the gun.
Like,
respectful.
You just use common sense, you know, be respectful if they're talking to you. Like, don't try to lie, because they will take you to jail. Like, the cops here, like, they see the most absurd things you can see anywhere, day in and day out, and the last thing they want to do is deal with some tourist who's giving them lip, you know, so.
Yeah.
Just be nice, like, if you're out just, like, moseying around or whatever, and you're drinking, as long as you're on Fremont Street or on the Strip, like, you're not gonna get any trouble. A lot of times they just come up to you because they're looking out for you. Like, a cop in this town can tell if you're a tourist. They can tell if you're a local. So if they come up to you, just be nice and you'll get helped out. It's always something good to keep in mind. Like, and the locals here, like your casino dealers, your hotel staff, they're going to be doing what they can to look out for you, but they obviously, like, they can't babysit you.
Right.
So be mindful of your surroundings. Be mindful of the people that you're associating with while you're here, because there's a shady character or two.
Or two.
Good advice.
We have tournaments coming up, Nat. So specifically what I was thinking about is there's a Twan Sirius Open.
I don't know if we can even publicize that. It's private event, invitation only.
Yeah, that I don't care.
That's what we're saying about it. It's private event.
If you have any questions about the event at all,
just forget it.
Yeah, feel free to call or text message 440-258-4341. Anthony Michaels will be available to answer any questions that you have.
And in addition to that, we just scheduled an event in Columbus for Memorial Day weekend on May 26th. So anyone's interested, they can get in on that.
Well, you've done it again. You've spent another hour listening to Serious Vintage. I'm Jeff Mose.
I'm Josh Chappell.
I'm Nat Mose. And we've been joined today by Joe McKellar and Heather Meek.
Hey.
Hi.
Thanks to both of them for being here, and we'll catch you next time.
All right, thanks for having us on.
Thank you. Take a little trip. Take a little trip. Take a little trip to see. Take a little trip. Take a little trip. Take a little trip with me.
Joe and Heather to say bye.
We can just put them in the rotation.
So long, farewell, I'll even say adieu.
No, not that.